Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super Florida fantastic. Coming to you live this evening from the Renaissance Marriott in Orlando, Florida, just across the street from SeaWorld. I can see SeaWorld out my window here, although I haven't
Well, is it business or pleasure? Is business or pleasure?
No, it's business. Yeah, I'm here at a conference.
Well, if you're going to have a business trip, it's nice to go someplace nice like that, right?
Well, I was saying before the show started, it's nice to get away from Colorado after we had basically one of our biggest ever October blizzards last week, and I ended up having to shovel about 2 feet of really wet, heavy snow over a period of about 3 days, and it was nice to kind of get down here into a warmer part of the country.
Yeah.
You probably don't do an awful lot of snow shoveling, do you, Stephen?
I don't think I've ever snow shoveled anything in my life. Number one, we just don't have a lot of snow, and
right.
The little bit of snow that we have, it's not enough to bother with. So yeah, it's not a chore that comes up. We have been flooding here in Louisiana. Portions of northwest Louisiana where I am are like underwater, lots of homes. So
yeah, well of course that's lots more serious than having a snow shovel for sure.
Can be, yeah. So anyway, weather's been pretty extreme here lately, hasn't it?
Yeah, very, very interesting. They're kind of having a heat wave down here in Florida. It sounds like it's very wet. And how are things west there, Sally? You're blowing
up. I just muted her mic. I'm not sure if she was having a little feedback there.
Oh, okay. Well, sounds like they're having a lot of feedback up there.
I guess so.
the upper Midwest. But our chat host, Sally Morham, is with us. A little technical difficulties, but she is available for those of you listening live via chat. So join us in the chat room, and we'll get the program rolling. So we're going to pick up our topic from last week. We were privileged to have Brian Wong with us once again last week. Brian, of course, the Director of Research for the Lifeboat Foundation and also the blogger at Accelerating Future. And we were talking before the show started. I think we should point out that the new Technorati rankings for science blogs were published last week. Actually, I don't know if they have been published all along, but I just saw a post about them over on Michael Anisimov's blog, Accelerating Future, and he pointed out that Brian is in the top 10 of science blogs in the world. And actually, Accelerating Future is listed in the top 30. So congrats to both those guys. I went looking for us, but apparently we're not listed as a science blog. I don't know how they list us over at Technorati, but we didn't show up on that list. So
I think that we're different enough that we're a little hard to categorize.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, I would classify us probably as a science blog, but we do something that's a little bit different from just typical science, and that is that we try to extrapolate and predict the future, speculate. So that's makes us a little bit different. So
I think we own a niche. That's called folksy transhumanism. Okay,
that's
what we do, and we're number one. Okay.
That's right. We're also in last place, but
yeah, that's true. Well, that keeps us on.
That's kind of a glass half empty thing. So,
yeah.
And that's not us. We're optimists. So yes, we are number one.
Yeah, no, we're number one. We are the folksy transhumanists for sure. So Anyway, congratulations to both those guys on those really well-deserved, I would say, rankings for their blogs. But we had Brian on talking about the future of energy, and of course that's such a broad set of topics. It's not even really one topic. It's just a whole sweeping subject matter area with hundreds of different angles into it and different ways of looking at it and just important pieces of it. So we thought, well, let's pick it up again this week and talk a little more energy.
Absolutely. And there was a major article that Brian had pointed to last week, and it was actually a Department of Defense paper. And we kind of laughed because Brian had called it skimmable.
Highly skimmable. Yeah.
It's actually quite dense with material. It's how many pages is it, Phil? It's 84 pages.
84 pages, but one thing Brian did point out is probably only the content is only about the first 40-some pages, and then the rest is slides and charts and things like that. So it's, you know, not to totally discourage people from reading it. We'll provide the link, but just know what you're getting into. That's our
Yeah. Well, but you know, that's not to say that, I mean, every single page has something interesting on it to me. I mean, it's an interesting topic, and I guess the point is the reason, you know, why is the Department of Defense talking about energy? Well, it turned, you know, they see energy as a huge security concern for the United States. You know, without energy, obviously they can't do what the Department of Defense can't do what it does to defend the country. But beyond that, the private sector can't do what it needs to do to fund everything else. So it sees, you know, a kind of a problem with the fact that we spend $300 billion a year, you know, sending it overseas just for our oil. You know, not to mention any other kind of energy we might import, but just for oil, $300 billion is what we send overseas every year. I mean, you know, after a while, that adds up, and so they see that as a potential security problem. So I'm glad somebody over at the Department of Defense is spending some time thinking about these things.
Well, and it's interesting, as you get into this paper, one of the things you realize, to step back and look at this from a standpoint, not just of the defense, but the issue generally, you know, the country runs on energy. I mean, it runs on, and a lot of that is oil, but I mean,
yeah.
Everything that happens has energy in the background. It has oil and nuclear and hydroelectric and just all the different ways that we produce power, making everything that happens possible. And the thing is, once you get into the field of defense, that is just a very specific instance of this. This is and a very energy consumptive, energy intensive instance. The Army runs on oil big time. That's one of the takeaways from there. And one of the
It just pointed out that the Department of Defense, the U.S. Department of Defense, is the single largest consumer, I guess, if you considered it one single consumer, the largest single consumer of petroleum in the world.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, they just need a lot of this black gold. You know, I mean, they just need a lot of petroleum to keep, you know, to keep this their operations going. And so,
and one of the really interesting, I should give the title, actually, the title of the paper is Energy and National Security: An Exploration of Threat Solutions and Alternative Futures. One of the points that the author makes early on is that they don't need to need as much as they do, and he gets into the subject of conservation. Some of the ideas are very straightforward. When you talk about, we've got tanks running on turbine engines, we could actually replace those with diesel engines. You'd get as much horsepower and tremendous fuel savings. Turbine was a sexier technology, and so we started putting into tanks for probably not terribly good military reasons, just because, hey, how cool that we got turbine engines in our tanks.
Well, let's go back to diesel, is his thought. The other thing he pointed to is, for example, we could retrofit the B-52s to take an engine that is 30% more efficient, and that is key. not just for the fuel that you burn in a B-52, but also it means that on a worldwide mission, which is often what happens, they take off here in Barksdale, right across the river from where I am, and fly the other side of the world, do what they need to do, and then fly back. And that can cut down the amount of times that they have to refuel in flight. And that means less fuel, not just for the B-52 itself, but also for the refueling aircraft. So there would be significant fuel savings for things like that.
It really starts to cascade at that point because you're going, well,
right.
You're saving 30% off the top. And then
right.
You go, oh, we're also saving all the fuel that was – and I'm thinking that probably those big fuel tank planes are pretty gas guzzly because, they're carrying all that fuel around, right? So those are probably – probably pretty significant savings if you can reduce the reliance on those. But let me read a little section. This really got my attention, and I just thought this was so kind of outside the box. He says that 80% of all U.S. materiel shipped in and to the Iraq forces was fuel.
Right.
If you look at the Iraq war, what are we shipping overseas?
Fuel.
Well, 80% of it is fuel.
Yeah.
90% of the fuel trucked to remotely deployed forces in Iraq and Afghanistan was used to air condition uninsulated tents. Long
yeah.
caravans of fuel trucks required to deliver the subsequent heavy fuel loads became vulnerable to an improvised explosive device or other guerrilla attack. If the tents were insulated to cut down on fuel use, heavy lift helicopter delivery or parafoil airdrop of the remaining small fraction of the current shipments could conceivably replace the truck caravans otherwise needed. Using less fuel could save lives. So you look at it and you go, wow.
That's big, and that just strikes me as obvious. Well, insulate the tents. I mean, I don't see why that isn't already done. But I guess it's like anything else. You get into a war and realize halfway through that the stuff that we started with is insufficient. We need to change the way we do things.
Right, and part of that is that you have a working solution, and you've got a war going on, right?
Right.
So, we've got tents that work, and we've got air conditioners, and so we can keep people cool, and so.
Which, by the way, is not just a luxury.
No, that's you're keeping people alive by keeping those tents air conditioned, absolutely. But it was a working solution, just like having turbine engines in the tanks is a working solution, right? And just like having B-52s that run at, 70% of the efficiency capacity that maybe they could achieve. Those are all working solutions, and, you're not thinking about, how much fuel are you consuming over an 8-year period of time if you're at war, right? Because that's just not part of the calculation when you go into it. But now, with the perspective of time and the recognition of the fact that consumption of energy is in and of itself a major security issue, it's like, you have to look at these things, and you have to make some smarter decisions than vis-a-vis energy than we've made in the past.
Right. I saw a picture. I wish I had the link to it at this moment, but I don't. I'll try to find it for the show notes. It showed a convoy stretching to the horizon, from front to back going into Iraq, and it was almost strictly fuel. And like you say, that's when you make a big target there when you have something like that. So if you can make those convoys smaller, then it's a smaller target.
Right. So you're making the whole enterprise of the war fundamentally safer because you're not as reliant on energy, and then you're making specifically people, on the ground a lot safer because they're not tangled up in these big long caravans of oil. I mean, what could be more attractive target, really, when you think about it, than just truck after truck, tanker loaded with oil? Yeah.
Related issue has nothing to do with energy. Well, it's only marginally related to energy, but the Department of Defense Grand Challenge. Basically to have robotic cars is for this purpose completely. If they can have like maybe one or two cars in a caravan that are human piloted and the rest just kind of follow along robotically, then that's it's less potential human lives lost.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
That's another part of the deal there. So anyway, but it's interesting to get that perspective because, you know, we're obviously you and I are civilians, Phil, and when we think of energy issues, we're thinking of it from a civilian perspective.
Right. And I think
usually.
Yeah. Well, and naturally we would, but it's interesting to look at it from this standpoint. One, because as you mentioned, they are the big consumers of power. So if you look at the country as a whole, anything you can do to make the military more efficient makes us as a nation more efficient from an energy standpoint. And then two, just the security issue, just the issue that this is a fundamental priority for keeping the country safe, is to make ourselves less reliant on other sources of energy, to make ourselves more fully in control of the energy that we're using. I guess that's really the point. Now, a couple other things from this before we move on to the next topic in energy, because just as he broadens out and talks about energy production generally, there are a couple other facts here that I found really interesting. He talks about ethanol, and ethanol gets the same no respect treatment that it gets in most places. That is to say, ethanol grown from standard food crops, as unfortunately is the case for how it's primarily done in the U.S. But he writes, although replacing all food crop production in the United States with corn or soybean growth for ethanol would not provide sufficient synthetic fuel to replace the 21, and I don't know if that's MBBL, is that millions of barrels?
MBBL, yeah, I would think that's what that is.
Okay, so I'm going to say 21 million barrels a day demand for oil, an area about 250 by 100 miles, that is to say equivalent to a 12.5-mile strip spanning the length of the U.S.-Mexican border, of algae production could provide synthetic fuel equivalent for the U.S. energy needs. And,
yeah,
he talks about how the Department of Defense could play a major role in moving that forward. The contrast between those two is astounding to me.
In other words, take all the croplands that we have.
Right, and just stop growing food.
Or continue to grow corn, but don't use any of it for food.
It's all ethanol.
Converted all the ethanol. Sorry, that's not enough.
It's not enough, yeah.
Yeah, but take this non-productive land, out in the deserts and things like that, to convert it. It's a large area, don't get me wrong, but by comparison, a small area of land, and convert it to algae production, and all of a sudden, that's all we need. So that's remarkable, the difference in per acre production of biofuel from algae as opposed to from corn.
That says to me that if a synthetic fuel is going to happen, algae certainly looks like a strong candidate, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
It just makes sense that would be the direction that we would be going in. And just from a business standpoint, somebody ought to be able to make something that is that efficient, that compact. If there is a way to make that into a viable fuel, I think we're going to see that happen in fairly short order.
I think so, too. I saw an article here recently, and again, I'll have to get it for the show notes, but it talked about five startups that are already in production and intend to have be producing algae-based biofuels that will hit the market in 2010. So, I mean, that's five active producing companies. Now, obviously, they'd be just a tiny percent of the liquid fuel that we need as a nation, but I mean, you got to start somewhere. And the fact that they feel like that they can make money, that to me, I think is key. Once you cross that barrier where a company believes that it can make money doing it, then it's just a matter of ramping up then.
Yeah. Well, and it looks to me like the gating factor is not producing the algae. I guess the gating factor would be scaling, turning the algae into fuel.
Right.
That's
well, there's lots of things that, I mean, for example, there algae can easily be contaminated with other organisms can get into your algae water, and that reduces your production significantly, and so you have to be real careful about that. And then there's bioengineering, basically the right kind of algae to maximize production, things like that. So there's lots of work to be done in the field, but even based on what we have so far, apparently they believe they could be profitable. So that's exciting.
Absolutely. Okay, one more snippet, and this one got me thinking about hydrogen again. We've kind of gone round and round with hydrogen.
Yeah, I think we kind of, you and I together sort of have dissed hydrogen, basically.
We have. I mean, we've talked about it maybe having an application, but we've also said compared to other things, it's probably not the strongest way to go. And I think there was a lot of hype around hydrogen and a lot of unrealistic thinking around it. Maybe, what, five years or so ago, people were, you know, talking about the hydrogen economy. And I think we've been pretty hard on the idea of a hydrogen economy, for sure.
Yeah.
But here's what he writes. He says, a kilogram of hydrogen can produce more than three times the amount of energy that a kilogram of gasoline or diesel will produce when they're burned. A hydrogen fuel cell has theoretically much higher efficiency than an ICE. I don't know what that is, actually. Some other kind of fuel cell, I suppose. Compactly stored hydrogen used in fuel cells operating at over 80% efficiency might provide a path to conserve energy, provide several factors, increase in platform endurance for military vehicles, and potentially eliminate, certainly mitigate, carbon emissions to the atmosphere. And he provides this table that has information in it that I've never seen produced anywhere, although I can't imagine that Zubrin didn't have this. Maybe he wouldn't have, though, because he was kind of down on hydrogen. But I can't remember ever reading anything that shows this comparison before. What it is, it shows fuel sources.
This is on page 12 of this paper, by the way.
Yeah, if you follow the link to the paper, it's on page 12. Table 1, fuel energy comparisons. He shows the name of the fuel and then how many megajoules per kilogram of that fuel you can get. So it's power per kilogram, and then how many you can get per liter. And it's astounding, the comparison between hydrogen and other sources of fuel. As I look at this, if you look just at the megajoules per kilogram, he shows hydrogen as having 143, regardless of what form it's in. But if you look at the megajoules per liter, actually hydrogen doesn't do as well as these other fuel sources, does it? Maybe I was impressed too quickly.
Well, if you ever doubt that there's a lot of power in hydrogen, review the Hindenburg films, you know. I mean, there's lots of power there. Now, the key, though, you know, why you and I have been down on hydrogen in the past is because, well, I mean, it typically has taken more energy to get hydrogen out of water, which is how we get it on this planet, is we split water to get hydrogen. It takes more energy to get hydrogen than you get out of hydrogen. So we're sitting here going, you know, we can't imagine how you could make a hydrogen economy. I mean, that's you know, you're working at a loss on that deal.
Right, the hydrogen economy has to be some other economy repackaged.
Right. So
hydrogen becomes a battery. It's a way of storing energy. And I think when those folks at MIT, what was that, about a year and a half ago, talked about this process for using solar power to make hydrogen essentially a means of storing solar power within a house, right? So you could you can heat your house with the sun while it's warm, and you're also storing some of that in the form of hydrogen, which you can then, when the sun goes down, you can continue to heat your house because you're going to start burning the hydrogen that you were splitting with some of that solar power.
Right.
And you're going to lose some of the power in the process, but what you gain is the transportability of
yeah. That. When the sun goes down, you still have power.
Yeah, you still have power. And yeah. it's the same thing with, you can't plug a car in. You know, you want an electric car, you want a car to have a fuel source that it can carry around with it. And that's where really advanced battery technology and possibly something that we could do with hydrogen really comes into play. And you and I were talking about this before the show, and you had some thoughts on how the two might fit together.
Well, I was actually thinking about a fusion economy. You have, you know, if we were to get some form of fusion or nuclear, or let's say we as a country decided we were going to go nuclear one way or another, either, you know, with proven fission reactors or with some new form of fusion or something like that, and we had all the electricity in the world that we needed, and let's say that petroleum were hard to come by. then what would we do for our to power cars and things like that? Well, we might just continue to improve battery technology until we're just all running around in electric vehicles. That would be awesome.
Right.
But you might also, be splitting water to store that power as hydrogen. Or you might be, using natural gas, compressed natural gas. There's, which we have plenty of in this country. And so, we could potentially go almost fully electric, and then still have plenty of fuel for transportation, either by converting electric to hydrogen, or by going after natural gas. And so,
I think that's exactly right. I think that's what we should start doing. In fact, wouldn't it make sense if we took that as one good potential end game for how we're going to carry energy around in the future for vehicles and so forth? If we said, okay, well, we know that ultimately we'd want to have fusion reactors splitting these water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen and providing all the hydrogen we need to drive our cars and so forth, plus giving us all the electricity we need to do everything else, right?
Right.
We don't have those yet. So an intermediate step would be we'll do that with fission reactors. And, hey, while we're building those, why don't we take all this natural gas we have and start splitting hydrogen with that so we can build the infrastructure to run everything off hydrogen fuel cells and then slowly step other means of producing it into play as we go, because we got lots of natural gas. And maybe rather than running the cars directly off natural gas, we use that natural gas to start this process of converting over to a fuel cell kind of battery-powered vehicle economy, which would then be better supported first by fission and then ultimately by fusion reactors.
Jerry Pournelle had written something, I think it was yesterday, that Glenn Reynolds over at Instapundit pointed to today regarding nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was fascinating and just it really speaks to what we're talking about here. He states, one estimate is that 500 nuclear power plants would make America energy independent. I think this is optimistic, in that an abundance of electricity doesn't mean we won't need to import oil for transportation needs, but it would certainly take us a long way towards independence. The cost would be in the order of $2 billion per plant. I would think less. The first one might be as much as $4 billion for a plant, but the 400th would be considerably less than $1 billion. But let's call it $2 billion each for these nuclear power plants. That's $1 trillion, comparable to the TARP or the stimulus, and for once a deficit that would actually pay us back.
Mm.
Inside 3 years, if you think about the fact that we're sending $300 billion overseas every year. So.
What's his time frame on how long it would take us to put those plants?
Okay, let's see. He says here it's less than the cost of a war, and less than the war is going to continue. The cost if we continue, the whole thing could be accomplished in 4 years. He says here.
Wow.
Of course, the ravening wolves in Congress won't do it, but then it's not likely that this kind of hope and change we can believe in from the current White House. So anyway, he gets a little political there, but that's. That's interesting. He thinks we could get it done in 4 years. You remember back in the 60s, they had what they called the Boat of the Month Club. Have you ever heard that phrase before?
No, I like it. The Boat of the Month Club.
Boat of the Month Club. This was height of the Cold War. We produced a nuclear sub every month.
Oh, really? Over what period of time?
The Nautilus rolled out. Ooh, that was, what, about 19... Somebody's going to have to look it up in the chat room for me. I think it was in the late 1950s that the first nuclear sub was produced, but then it was maybe a while before we got up to speed. But during the 60s, we were rolling one out a month. And, if we were to say this is a national priority, we are going to do this, we could get rolling. I think we could get rolling with one a month. And basically that we could be energy independent.
You need two nuclear power plants in every state, new ones, right? And we're there. That's what he was talking about, 100 nuclear power –
No. He said 500
nuclear power plants in every state, and we're
– Yeah. Well, I mean, that's – and a lot of people are going, oh, no, nuclear is dangerous. Well, not one person in this country has died from a nuclear accident. No one, not one single person died because of Three Mile Island.
True. And now, people did die because of Chernobyl. But
that's right. That's right. And Chernobyl irradiated a whole section of the Soviet Union. But there are things that we've learned. Well, number one, we didn't do plants like that. They were doing plants in a more dangerous manner. But we have learned from their disaster, and we know what to do to keep from doing that. For example, we have basically some meltdown-proof designs. Was it pebble bed nuclear reactor, for example?
Right. Yeah, Brian's talked about this a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, if you were using smaller reactors like that are comparable with what we put in subs, those cannot melt down either. They're just too small to produce the power to melt down. So, you know, it's there's ways of doing it safe, and we, you know, as a country, if we made it a priority, I think we could do it, and we could be energy independent. And not that we necessarily need to be 100% energy independent, but we just need to lift some of the burden off of ourselves. So that, you know, we, for both security and just freedom purposes, you know.
Well, I think we need to be very future directed, and we need to be moving more towards energy independent and away from being energy dependent. And you know, whether the end game is we are 90% or 95% or 85%, you know, whatever the,
or even 60%, you
whatever
know, I mean,
the number is, I don't know.
Yeah, but moving in that direction is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, yeah, we should move in that direction. I have a friend; she is a freelance writer. She does a lot of corporate assignment type work. She works for large companies and for smaller companies, and she does a variety of different things. Last week she was out in Southern California at the big solar power conference, and she was talking to me about this the other night. We were having my wife and I were having dinner with her family, and one of the things that got her attention is who are the big investors in solar and wind power in this country? Big projects that are going to take place.
All guys. T. Boone Pickens for one.
Well, yes, yeah, he's the only one. And in fact, most of the really big projects they're talking about, big wind projects, big solar projects, the money is coming from India and China. So we face this situation where not only are we importing oil from other countries, we might start producing our own internal energy from these alternative sources and have that infrastructure owned by foreign countries, which is just kind of outrageous when you think about it.
I don't even have anything to say about that. That's just, it's bizarre.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's absolutely bizarre. Well, and to think, and I don't know, you know, to go back to Jerry Pournelle's numbers, if the government's ever going to lay out a flat trillion again, and I don't know if we'll give them the opportunity to do that again anytime soon, but if they ever do, yeah, how about for something really that pushes us along, like what Pournelle is talking about, you know, that moves us in the direction of having a better ownership of our own economy, right, of our own future, of our own destiny. This seems like, you know, fundamental forward thinking, future directed thinking that is really lacking in kind of the big picture leadership that we get. And if this is getting political, you know, so be it.
So be it. Yeah. Well, let's visit with Sally a little bit in the chat room, because it looks like they're having an interesting discussion over there.
What do you got for us, Sally?
Okay. Am I on the line now?
You sure?
I'm really having trouble keeping a line on. What we've been talking about, the Hindenburg, and we've been talking about Pournelle. One of the things I said was, one of the problems with nukes now is we're so scared of them. The political genie is just saying, no, 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 don't do nukes, it's too scary. And one of the reasons people are scared of them is 30 to 40 year technology. We have two nuclear power plants in Minnesota, and they were built in the 70s.
Right.
So everyone thinks it's going to be that kind of technology if we go for the Pournelle 500 nukes in the nation, whereas I think that if you have the new tech, smaller nukes, you'd be actually a lot safer. doing some of the other things that we've been doing.
Certainly it'd be safer than coal-fired power plants, wouldn't it? You're not putting dangerous chemicals into the atmosphere, and particularly
exactly, that too.
If you can avoid the issue of melting down by using safer designs, smaller designs, then hey, why not, right?
And another thing is, it seems like every regulation that the federal government puts on us punishes American production and encourages more energy dependence. They're doing exactly the opposite every single step of the way of what we should be doing to really be.
And you know, a lot of this
investing in the high technology and thinking about our future.
Right. Well, a lot of this, you know, they might have the best intentions. Use cap and trade to reduce our environmental impact and things like that. Well, you know, our economy is pretty much dead, and we need. You know, it seems to me that you know we have other priorities that we need to think about as well. So yeah, and by going nuclear, and doing other things as well, we could avoid some of the worst of that.
Well, great question here from Dusty. He says, how about geothermal? And you know what? You don't hear an awful lot about geothermal. I would hesitate but venture to guess that we could probably be getting quite a bit of power from just the heat that's down there underground, but it's never been broadly implemented. And he asks, is it because maybe the drilling technology just isn't there yet?
Well, I think that it's coming. A lot of the drilling technology that was necessary to get to the natural gas that's right under my feet, this is the Haynesville Shale you probably have heard about in the news. It's 10,000 feet below where I stand,
mm-hmm.
And that's just been unreachable until the recent past. And now, what they're doing is, you know, they're drilling down 2 miles and then they drill out horizontally 1 mile, fracking six times as they go. Now, what fracking is, they're exploding, they're doing explosives so that it explodes the rock so that the natural gas can seep into the line at these 6 points. And so they'll go out horizontally 1 mile after that. Now, that has nothing to do, obviously, with geothermal, except that geothermal, I believe, is about twice the distance down.
Okay.
In most places. So instead of going down 2 miles, you need to go down about 4, is my understanding. That's, you know, it's just been hard to do, but they are, you know, they're getting the technology in place. And so once you can do that, it's really, really simple to do. I mean, you just, it's almost 19th century how simple it is. Once you got a hole down there to the heat, you just shoot water down there, and the water comes shooting back up as steam, and the steam drives a turbine.
Right.
And there you have electricity.
It's about as pure a model as you can have. Huh?
Just about as easy as it can be.
Well, it's interesting how something that probably didn't get the attention or the credit that it deserved plays such a huge role in tapping into new energy, and that is drilling technology.
Right.
Because the Russians, I guess back in the late 90s and early part of this decade, they were the ones who, I guess, really took the lead in drilling super deep for oil, and they were hitting oil reserves that no one else had ever been able to get to just because they improved their drilling technology and their drilling techniques. It sounds like we're piggybacking that now to get to natural gas we couldn't get to before. And, yeah, I think it's reasonable to extrapolate that pretty soon we'll be able to drill all the way through. I mean, you know, get down to the heat.
Get to the geothermal, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, practically inexhaustible. You know, I mean, you know, how long would it take for us to cool the world down by sending water down there? So, you know,
I think we wouldn't have to worry about that too.
Yeah, that's right. So, geothermal will, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of places in the United States that the geothermal is a lot closer to the surface than 4 miles, but. You know.
Well, let's go to Yellowstone. In fact, I don't know if you ever watch on Discovery Channel or National Geographic. Every now and then they do one of these shows about how Yellowstone is this huge steaming caldera that's going to explode one of these days and among other things, wipe Denver off the face of the earth. So, you know,
well, wipe out the Southwest. I mean, you know,
yeah.
It wouldn't just be Denver. It'd be half the country, a third of the country. Well, yeah, if there's anything we can do to kind of let off some steam.
Yeah, exactly. You know, kill two birds here, right?
Yeah, that's right. Take some of the energy out of that coming explosion and turn it into electricity for us. That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a good way to go. And I wonder if there isn't a geothermal solution that could be implemented even in the same kind of time frame that Pornell is talking about for nuclear fission. Potentially, you wouldn't have the big political fight. You don't have the, like, brand damage that's been done to nuclear fission. You know, the problem with nuclear is it's, you got to have this argument every time you talk about it, right? You got to have this three mile island argument, and the whole thing about meltdown and
well, you know, my thoughts about that is that, you know, you're always going to have, regardless of what we do as far as getting our own power, you're going to have environmentalists upset, and I'm not saying that to be cynical about environmentalists. I think that you know, some of the things that they've done has been absolutely wonderful for our world. I mean, when we can't build windmills without being told that we're going to kill a bird, you know, I wonder if there's any energy that would satisfy some of the more hardcore environmentalists. So.
Well, I would say to date, I haven't heard anyone get too upset about solar.
Yeah.
And I've never heard anyone get upset about geothermal, but maybe they do.
Well, I'm going to tell you what would upset them is the amount of water it takes to drill that deep.
Mm.
And, you know, if you start lowering water tables in order to get down that deep, then somebody's going to make a complaint. So that's where the complaint would come from eventually.
Okay, well, there would be a complaint. I still think that there'd be less argument about that than there would nuclear. That's
sure.
I think it just sounds clean. Geothermal.
Yeah.
It just sounds so clean. Well, anyhow, what else we got? I know we've kind of
been all over the map.
Yeah, we've moved all over the place on these, but I know we had a number of these stories in energy that we wanted to talk
about.
Well,
one thing that we just touched very briefly on last week was the idea of space-based solar.
Hmm.
And, you know, I don't ever want to you know, I always want to be very hesitant in disagreeing with Brian. You know, he's just a smart guy.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, you really want to have your facts in order, I think.
Yeah, he didn't think much of it. I think not necessarily, and I don't think that he's necessarily saying it will never happen. I just think he sees it as not a short-term solution necessarily.
Right.
But, you know, think about With space-based solar, you get solar power 24 hours a day.
Right.
There's, you know, you're high enough in orbit that the Earth never blocks the sun, and you've always got solar going, and you beam it down to Earth with a beam that and to a receiving station, and my understanding is that a receiving station a mile in diameter could provide enough power for 1 million homes. And that's, you know, and that's pretty cool. And just think if you had a receiving, you set up a receiving station in Iraq, there goes all of a sudden you don't need the convoys, right? Bringing in the fuel,
right? Yeah, exactly.
So you just beam the power anywhere in the world you need to. So I that appeals to me. I think that there's something there, and there's
couple hundred of these. 1 mile diameter receiving stations, 200 of those, and that would actually take care of all the energy needs for America.
Yeah, how many millions of people do we have in the United States? 200
like 300
million?
300 million.
300 million. Okay. So if you had if it took a mile for each million, yeah, that's what you're talking.
For each million houses, right?
Yeah.
Houses have.
Yeah, yeah. A house would have more than one person.
So,
in it. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, that's another way of getting there, right? It seems like, and this is This was Brian's point at the end of the show last week. It's like you might not have to have one big silver bullet,
right?
Heroic solution that comes in and saves the day. It seems that there's a lot of potential from several of these things. And just question: how do you get the power down from the satellites?
Microwave.
Oh, okay. So
send it down by microwave. And so, you know, and the issue is, well, are you going to microwave jets that happen to fly through it? You know, you're sitting there in a commercial airliner with some popcorn in your lap, and it starts popping.
It starts to pop, yeah.
What happens? I mean,
that's disturbing.
Well, it's, obviously, you would. There's a couple of ways you would avoid that. Obviously, you'd make that no fly zones, you know. But also, it's. I think that it would be diffuse enough that where you happen to stray in there momentarily, you wouldn't fry yourself necessarily. So, that's how they would do it with microwave.
Here, this would be an interesting analysis. We got to get somebody who knows how to do these things to do this for us. Offhand, I would say, okay, infrastructure. If we were going to, let's just, the three we've been talking about so far as kind of three big possibilities. If we were going to go geothermal to solve our energy problems, or if we were going to go nuclear fission,
okay.
Or if we were going to go space-based solar, which is the greater infrastructure challenge of the three?
Well, getting things into outer space is expensive.
Yeah, but it's a known problem. We know how to
do
it.
Yeah.
Although I don't think we've ever put anything up there that's a mile in diameter. Theoretically, we can.
No. I'm talking the receiving station has to be a mile in diameter.
On the Earth.
Yeah, on the Earth.
How big does the solar receptor up in space have to be?
I do not know. Sorry. I don't know. But I did not get the impression it's a mile.
Orbiting the Earth.
Yeah.
Image in my head.
Yeah, I did not get the impression it had to be a mile.
This was like my Zeppelins flying around Mars, okay? It was.
I'm sorry, I messed
really
with your image there.
Good point though. We've got two issues actually. We've got to launch all these solar collectors,
right.
And we got to build these Earth stations. So
right.
Between the two, that and nuclear, I would say nuclear sounds easier.
Geothermal sounds easier too.
Geothermal sounds easier, but it's not invented, right?
Well, it kind of is though. I mean, we have some geothermal power in this country. It's small. And,
right, but the breakthrough that you were talking about, where we
can put a geothermal plant anywhere, we don't have to go where it's shallow. We can go anywhere in the country. That's kind of on the horizon, yeah.
Right, right. That one involves, I think, very predictable breakthrough based on what's occurred already with drilling technology. And per your point earlier, once you've got the pipe, this is the simplest of all. I guess it's right up there with hydroelectric, right? It's just
right.
you put a turbine in the way of pressure and you've got power. It's
exactly.
It's just kind of beautiful that way. So good call, Dusty, on the geothermal. I think that one's got some legs. I think that's one that probably needs to get a little more respect than it currently does.
Well,
ultimately, I still think we go to fusion in the long run. I think that's where we end up.
Well, you know, the things that don't pollute our planet, the ways that we can provide power for ourselves that don't pollute the planet. See if I get them all, okay?
Okay.
Wind, solar, natural gas, nuclear, which I'm including both fission and fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Tidal, geothermal. Space-based solar, and I'm counting it differently than just solar because it is so different.
Right.
And then biofuel. And the reason I say biofuel, you're thinking, well, biofuel, doesn't that put carbon in the atmosphere and all and pollutants and everything else just like regular fuel? Well, the thing is, when you grow algae, it's sequestering carbon. And so when you burn it and you release the carbon, you're carbon neutral.
Yeah, you're just reusing the carbon that was already
the same carbon. So. And so those are the ones that I would consider to be these are the carbon neutral ways to produce power. Any combination
neutral.
Of those things, I mean.
Although there are environmental impacts with each. With nuclear fission, you got radioactive waste that you have to deal with one way or another somehow. You do
right. Fusion, you would have a whole lot less of that.
Right. Fusion. Does not have that problem. Now, how about this geothermal? Is it possible you tap into some really nasty greenhouse gases that are trapped down there in the mantle somewhere, and you let a bunch of those up in the process of
you know, like the methane burp that people talk about.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess you would want to do some definite geological studies to make sure you weren't doing something like that. Yeah.
But here's with that in mind, with the fact that gases can be trapped deep in the earth, and drilling technology has improved so much, now we can kind of turn this one on its head and say, well, maybe drilling technology takes us to yet another unexpected breakthrough, which is that we can start burning coal like there's no tomorrow because really good drilling technology makes it possible for us to truly sequester the carbon emissions from burning coal. So we can start burning coal and putting all that carbon down there way deep in the earth where it won't do any harm.
Absolutely. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm going to go ahead and put the link in the chat room because I happen to have this one handy, that mentions the title of the article is Five Technologies That Could Change Everything. And that is one of the technologies they mention, is the our ability to sequester carbon from coal or any coal power plants or anything else that is producing carbon, put it down in a layer of rock that can absorb it. And, the only problem with that is that carbon's not the only thing that you release when you burn coal. And since the process of sequestering the carbon is going to take more energy, you actually end up producing more other bad things just to sequester the carbon. So my thought is, let's get away from coal. Let's figure out other ways of doing things. But anyway, that is one of the things that was listed here in this article, Five Technologies That Could Change Everything.
Well, and interestingly, if you go just to swing it back to the Department of Defense report, if you look at the megajoules per liter of all the different energy sources, coal really kicks butt, okay?
Yeah, there's a lot of energy there.
Yeah, it's twice again the next closest one. So if there was some get-out-of-jail-free card with coal, it would be great. But, it would really have to be a pretty elaborate system to really let you get that energy.
Since coal basically is carbon. I mean, that's what it is.
Carbon dioxide, all the carbon monoxide,
soot
and other, wonderful things. But
we've got lots and lots of carbon. If somebody come up with a way of making a liquid fuel out of it that we can burn without, producing a lot of pollution. That would be an awesome way to go, but so far that hadn't happened. So, the listing of the five technologies that could change everything: space-based solar is what they mentioned here.
Mm-hmm. These are energy technologies.
These are all energy technologies: space-based solar, advanced car batteries. Now, I think that's key because right now, a gallon of gasoline just kicks the butt of any battery,
right?
That we can produce. Even the best lithium-ion battery is per weight does not hold a candle to a gallon of gasoline. You just can't. It's hard to beat that, and that's one of the reasons we haven't gotten away from petroleum. Utility storage, in other words, being able to gather things, gather power through solar or through wind and storing it. Again, I think one way you could do that is not just with batteries, but also by producing hydrogen. And
right.
It's
the same thing. We want to start thinking of the future of batteries as hydrogen. I feel that ultimately hydrogen wins the battery wars once we figure out a good way to use it, just because for the foreseeable future, I expect hydrogen to remain the most abundant element in the universe. And as long as that's true, it seems to me it has a tremendous advantage over other stuff. Plus, it is carbon neutral.
Yeah, that's right.
And virtually, not just carbon neutral, it is like
everything neutral. It's
environmental
very clean.
Footprint neutral. I mean, it's the most abundant element.
If we can just control the whole exploding Hindenburg blimp problem.
Don't make pure hydrogen gas and light it on fire.
Yeah,
and don't put it in a bomb and make a fusion bomb out of it. If you avoid those two things, I think it's really hard to mess up with that,
isn't it? And number four was carbon capture and storage in this article, and the last, number five, was next generation biofuels. So they're
okay,
they're really high on this algae, you know.
I think we've touched on all those. And
yep.
Between the big three we talked about, the kind of fourth one we added, which was going back to coal and sequestering that, and then just this idea of a relatively small amount of space to grow biofuels, I can't help but think that the energy future is not as bleak as some would have us believe.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to political will to do what needs to be done. And, you know, I sometimes grow concerned that we're going to have to experience a lot of pain before we'll do things that we need to do in order to be more energy independent. And I don't know, you know, how much pain is that going to require before we decide, hey, we need to, you know, let's get to work on nuclear power plants or geothermal or you know, space-based solar or whatever needs to be done. I don't know. You know, we'll see. But, you know, it would be cool if people just going out trying to make a buck start the process before the pain really gets intense.
Well, if we could be guided by pain avoidance rather than pain relief, and in fact turn that pain avoidance on its head, and if we could be motivated by just the tremendous benefits we could provide to our own world by taking the upper hand in this, it seems like we'd make that progress without having to go through all the pain. But
right.
But that comes back to getting people to think differently, and that might be the hardest challenge of all.
Might be. Well, we have gotten to a point, kind of to a stopping point here, Phil, and maybe we might actually let the chat room hear our music this week.
Okay. You know, we've taken it to a natural stopping point, as you said, although I think we might next week, if nothing else intervenes, let's take up this topic of the will and changing how people are motivated towards working towards a new future. I think that'll be an interesting topic for us.
Absolutely.
All right, so tell us about the music this week.
The music, really upbeat music this week, and I think it goes well with the topic we've discussed tonight. It is Dare to Dream is the name of the song, and the artist is Adam Alami.
Adam Alami singing Dare to Dream, a perfect anthem for our two-week series on energy. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and for all the work you put into preparing for these two shows. Sally, thanks to you, to all our friends in the chat room, for everyone listening live, and for everyone listening to us via recording. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you all again next week. And until then, live to see it.
Not everyone knows how, and everyone's got a treasure inside, trying to find its way out. And we're all scared of failure.